part occurred. He suffered anxiety attacks every 2 weeks or so in connection with hostile or sexual thoughts. To him, flying was exciting, rewarding in its expression of hostility and power. In another case history, Aronson described an Air Force captain who developed full-blown paranoid schizophrenia at the age of 33. His behavior became grandiose, inappropriate, and demanding. He considered himself the real commander of his unit and gave orders to a superior officer. At the height of these delusions, the captain nevertheless managed to log 8 hours on the B-25 bomber with unimpaired proficiency. Aronson thought that an unauthorized nuclear detonation would have a unique appeal to people suffering from a variety of paranoid delusions. Those who were seeking fame, who believed themselves invested with a special mission that sets them apart from society, who wanted to save the world and thought that the authorities covertly wish destruction of the enemy but are uncomfortably constrained by outmoded convention. In addition to the mentally ill, officers and enlisted men with poor impulse control might be drawn to nuclear weapons. The same need for immediate gratification that pyromaniacs often exhibited, the desire to see the tangible result of their own power as it brings about a visual holocaust, might find expression in detonating an atomic bomb. A number of case histories in the report illustrated the unpredictable, often infantile nature of impulse-driven behavior. An assistant cook improperly obtained a charge of TNT in order to blast fish. He lighted it with a cigarette. As he was examining it to make sure it was ignited, the explosion took place. The man was blown to pieces. "Private B and I each found a rifle grenade. We carried them back to our tent. Private K told us that we had better not fool with the grenades and to get rid of them. Private B said, 'What will happen if I pull this pin?' Then the grenade exploded. A Marine found a 37mm dud and turned it into the quartermaster tent. Later, a sergeant came into the tent and saw the dud. In disregard of orders and safety, he aimed the shell at a hole in the wooden floor of the tent and dropped it. He commented that he would make a pretty good bombardier. He dropped the shell at least 6 times. Finally, inevitably, it exploded. The sergeant was killed and 2 others were injured. Even relatively harmless motives, such as the urge to defy authority, the desire to show off, and the kind of curiosity which does not quite believe the consequences of one's own acts, could cause a nuclear detonation. The unauthorized destruction of a city or a military base would be disastrous, and Eclay addressed the question of whether such an event could precipitate something even worse. Nikita Khrushchev had recently claimed that an accidental atomic bomb explosion may well trigger another world war. The scenario seemed far-fetched, but couldn't be entirely dismissed. Amid the chaos following an explosion, it might not be clear that the blast had been caused by a technical malfunction, human error, a madman, or saboteurs. The country where the detonation occurred might think that a surprise attack had begun and retaliate. Its adversary, fearing that sort of retaliation, might try to strike first. Eclay believed that, at the moment, the risk of accidental war was small. He thought the leadership of both the United States and the Soviet Union would carefully investigate the cause of a single detonation before launching an all-out attack. And he felt confident that America could withstand the loss of a major city without much long-term social or economic upheaval. But an unauthorized detonation in the United States or Western Europe could have unfortunate political consequences. It could fuel support for disarmament and neutrality, increase opposition to American bases overseas, weaken the NATO alliance, and facilitate a peaceful expansion of the Soviet sphere of influence. Indeed, the military and political benefits to the Soviet Union would be so great that it might be tempted to sabotage an American weapon. The U.S. defense posture could be substantially strengthened by nuclear weapons safeguards that would give a nearly absolute guarantee against unauthorized detonations, Eclay concluded. He urged that more research be conducted on nuclear weapons safety, that new safety mechanisms be added to warheads and bombs, that Air Force personnel be screened more thoroughly for psychiatric problems. And he offered one solution to the problem of unauthorized use that seemed obvious, yet hadn't been tried. Put combination locks on nuclear weapons. That way they could be detonated only by someone who knew the right code. None of these measures, however, could make weapons perfectly safe, and the United States had to be prepared for accidental or unauthorized detonations. In a subsequent RAND report, Eclay offered suggestions on how to minimize the harm of an accidental nuclear explosion. If such an accident occurred in a remote area so that leakage to the press could be prevented, no information ought to be made public. If the accident has been compromised and public statements become necessary, they should depict the accident as an occurrence which has no bearing on the safety of other weapons. In some circumstances, it might be treated as if it had been an experiment. Internally, of course, information about the accident should not be suppressed. An official board of inquiry should be established, headed by military experts and prominent politicians, as an important device for temporizing. Ideally, the board would take a few months to reach any conclusions. During this delaying period, the public information program should provide the news media with all possible news about rehabilitation and relief. There is always a strong and continued interest in such news after a disaster. Within a relatively short time, the interest in rehabilitation tends to crowd out reports about destruction and casualties. If an American bomber launched an unauthorized attack on the Soviet Union, Eclay argued that the United States should avoid public self-implication and delay the release of any details about the accident. Then it should begin secret diplomatic negotiations with the Soviets. Amid the tensions of the Cold War, thanks to a military strategy that made the United States and its NATO allies completely dependent on nuclear weapons, Eclay's thinking reached a perverse but logical conclusion. After the accidental detonation of an atomic bomb, the president might have a strong incentive to tell the Soviet Union the truth and lie to the American people. Fred Eclay's reports on nuclear weapons safety were circulated at the highest levels of the Air Force and the Department of Defense, but his work remained unknown to most weapon designers and mid-level officers. In 1958, Bob Purifoy was a section supervisor at Sandia, working on the electrical system of the W-49 warhead. Development of the W-49 was considered urgent. Lightweight and thermonuclear, the warhead would be mounted atop Atlas, Thor, and Jupiter ballistic missiles. During the rush to bring it into production, Purifoy was surprised to read some of the language in a preliminary safety study of the W-49. "This warhead, like all other warheads investigated, can be sabotaged, i.e., detonated full-scale," the Air Force study mentioned in passing. "Any person with knowledge of the warhead electrical circuits, a handful of equipment, a little time, and the intent can detonate the warhead." Purifoy hadn't spent much time thinking about nuclear weapons safety. His job at Sandia was making sure that bombs would explode. But the ease with which someone could intentionally set off a W-49 seemed incredible to him. It was unacceptable. And so was the Air Force's willingness to rely on physical security, armed guards, perimeter fences, etc., as the only means of preventing an unauthorized detonation. Purifoy decided that the warhead should have an internal mechanism to prevent sabotage or human error from detonating it. Plans were already being made to incorporate a trajectory sensing switch into the new Mark 28 bomb, and Purifoy thought that the W-49 should contain one too. The switch responded to changes in gravitational force. It contained an accelerometer, a small weight atop a spring enclosed in a cylinder. As G-forces increased, the weight pushed against the spring, like a passenger pushed back against the seat of an accelerating car. When the spring fully compressed, an electrical circuit closed, allowing the weapon to be detonated. In the Mark 28 bomb, the switch would be triggered by the sudden jerk of the parachute's opening. Purifoy wanted to use the strong G-forces of the warhead's descent to close the circuit. A trajectory-sensing switch would prevent the weapon from going off while airmen handled or serviced it, since the necessary G-forces wouldn't be present on the ground. A skilled technician could circumvent the switch, but its placement deep within the warhead would make an act of sabotage trickier and more time-consuming. The Army didn't like Purifoy's idea. A switch that operated as the W-49 warhead fell to earth, the Army contended, might somehow make the weapon less reliable. The Army also didn't like what Sandia engineers called the switch, a handling safety device or a goof-proofer. Both terms implied that Army personnel were capable of making mistakes. Purifoy thought that sort of thinking was sheer stupidity. But the Army ran the Jupiter missile program and had the final say on its fusing and firing system. Under enormous pressure to complete the design of the warhead's electrical system, Purifoy said to hell with it and simply reversed the direction of the tiny springs. Now the switch would respond to the G-forces of the missile soaring upward, not those of the warhead coming down, and the Army couldn't complain that its control of the fusing and firing system was being challenged. To avoid any hurt feelings, Sandia renamed the switch, calling it an environmental sensing device. At Los Alamos, the issue of one-point safety gained renewed attention as SAC began to fly planes with fully assembled weapons. A young physicist, Robert K. Osborne, began to worry that a number of the bombs carried during airborne alerts might not be one-point safe. Among those raising the greatest concern was the Mark 28, a hydrogen bomb with a yield of about 1 megaton. Any problem with the Mark 28 would be a big problem. The Air Force had chosen it not only to become the most widely deployed bomb in the Strategic Air Command, but also to serve as a tactical weapon for NATO fighter planes. In December 1957, the Fission Weapon Committee at Los Alamos had struggled to define what one-point safe should mean as a design goal. If the high explosives of a weapon detonated at a single point, some fission was bound to occur in the core before it blew apart. And so zero yield was considered unattainable. A naval officer at the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project suggested that the yield of a nuclear weapon accident should never exceed the explosive force produced by 4 pounds of TNT. The 4-pound limit was based on what might happen during an accident at sea. If a nuclear detonation with a yield larger than 4 pounds occurred in the weapons storage area of an aircraft carrier, it could incapacitate the crew of the engine room and disable the ship. Los Alamos proposed that the odds of a yield greater than 4 pounds should be 1 in 100,000. The Department of Defense asked for an even stricter definition of one-point safety, odds of 1 in 1,000,000. The likelihood of a Mark 28 producing a large detonation during a plane crash or a fire, Osborne now thought, was uncomfortably high. The one-point safety tests conducted in Nevada had assumed that the most vulnerable place on a weapon was the spot where a detonator connected to a high-explosive lens. That's why the tests involved setting off a single lens with a single detonator. But Osborne realized that nuclear weapons had an even more vulnerable spot, a corner where 3 lenses intersected on the surface of the high-explosive sphere. If a bullet or a piece of shrapnel hit one of those corners, it could set off 3 lenses simultaneously, and that might cause a nuclear detonation a lot larger than 4 pounds of TNT. A new round of full-scale tests on the Mark 28 would be the best way to confirm or disprove Osborne's theory. But those tests would be hard to perform. Ignoring strong opposition from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, President Eisenhower had recently declared a moratorium on American nuclear testing. He was tired of the arms race and seeking a way out of it. He increasingly distrusted the Pentagon's claims. Testing is essential for weapons development, General Charles H. Bonestell had argued, succinctly expressing the military's view. and rapid weapons development is essential for keeping ahead of the Russians. But Eisenhower doubted that the United States was at risk of falling behind. The Air Force and the CIA had asserted that the Soviet Union would have 500 long-range ballistic missiles by 1961, outnumbering the United States by more than 7-1. Eisenhower thought those numbers were grossly inflated. Top-secret flights over the Soviet Union by U-2 spy planes had failed to detect anywhere near that number of missiles. Despite the Democratic attacks on his administration and dire warnings of a missile gap, President Eisenhower thought it was more important to preserve the secrecy of America's intelligence methods than to refute his critics. The nuclear test ban was voluntary, but he hoped to make it permanent. In the words of one advisor, Eisenhower had become entirely preoccupied by the horror of nuclear war. The harsh criticism of his policies, not just by Democrats but also by defense contractors, led Eisenhower to believe in the existence of a military-industrial complex, a set of powerful interest groups that threatened American democracy and sought new weapons regardless of the actual need. The Air Force was in a bind. The hydrogen bomb, scheduled to become its workhorse, deployed at air bases throughout the United States and Europe, might be prone to detonate during a plane crash, and full-scale tests of the weapon would violate the nuclear moratorium that Eisenhower had just promised to the world. While the Air Force and the Atomic Energy Commission debated what to do, the Mark 28 was grounded. Norris Bradbury, the director of Los Alamos, recommended that a series of tests be secretly conducted. The tests would be called hydronuclear experiments. Mark 28 cores containing small amounts of fissile material would be subjected to one-point detonations, and more fissile material would be added with each new firing until a nuclear yield occurred. The largest yield that might be produced would be roughly equivalent to that of 1 pound of TNT. None of these experiments would be done without the president's approval. Eisenhower was committed to a test ban, disarmament, and world peace, but he also understood the importance of the Mark 28. He authorized the detonations, accepting the argument that they were not a nuclear weapon test because the potential yields would be so low. At a remote site in Los Alamos, without the knowledge of most scientists at the laboratory, cores were detonated in tunnels 50 to 100 feet beneath the ground. The tests confirmed Osborne's suspicions. The Mark 28 wasn't one-point safe. A new core, with a smaller amount of plutonium, replaced the old one, and the bomb was allowed to fly again. 4 years after announcing the policy of massive retaliation, Secretary of State John Foster Dulles was having doubts. "Are we becoming prisoners of our strategic concept?" he asked at a meeting of Eisenhower's military advisors, "and caught in a vicious circle?" A defense policy that relied almost entirely on nuclear weapons had made sense in the early days of the Cold War. The alternatives had seemed worse: maintain a vast and expensive army, or cede Western Europe to the communists. But the Soviet Union now possessed hydrogen bombs and long-range missiles, and the American threat of responding to every act of Soviet aggression, large or small, with an all-out nuclear attack no longer seemed plausible. It could force the president to make a bitter choice during a minor conflict and risk the survival of the United States. Dulles urged the Joint Chiefs of Staff to come up with a new strategic doctrine, one that would give the president a variety of military options and allow the United States to fight small-scale, limited wars. General Maxwell D. Taylor, the Army's Chief of Staff, wholeheartedly agreed with Dulles. For years, Taylor had urged Eisenhower to spend more money on conventional forces and adopt a strategy of flexible response. The Army hated the idea of serving merely as a tripwire in Europe. It still wanted to bring the battle back to the battlefield. The need for a more flexible policy was backed by RAND analysts and by a young Harvard professor, Henry A. Kissinger, whose book Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy had become an unlikely bestseller in 1957. Kissinger thought that a nuclear war with the Soviet Union didn't have to end in mutual annihilation. Rules of engagement could be tacitly established between the superpowers. The rules would forbid the use of hydrogen bombs, encourage a reliance on tactical nuclear weapons, and declare cities more than 500 miles from the battlefield immune from attack. Unlike massive retaliation, a strategy of graduated deterrence would allow the leadership on both sides to pause for calculation, pull back from the abyss, and reach a negotiated settlement. Kissinger believed that in a limited war, fought with a decentralized command structure that let local commanders decide how and when to use their nuclear weapons, the United States was bound to triumph, thanks to the superior daring and leadership of its officers. The Navy had also begun to question the thinking behind massive retaliation. It was about to introduce a new weapon system, the Polaris submarine, that might revolutionize how nuclear wars would be fought. The 16 missiles carried by each Polaris were too inaccurate to be aimed at military targets, such as airfields. But their 1 megaton warheads were ideal for destroying soft targets like cities. The Polaris would serve best as a retaliatory second strike weapon, leading the Navy to challenge the whole notion of striking the Soviet Union first. Admiral Arleigh Burke, the chief of naval operations, became an outspoken proponent of finite deterrence. Instead of maintaining thousands of strategic weapons on Air Force bombers and land-based missiles to destroy every Soviet military target, a seemingly impossible task, Burke suggested that the United States needed hundreds, not thousands, of nuclear warheads. They could be carried by the Navy's Polaris submarines, hidden beneath the seas, invulnerable to a surprise attack. And they would be aimed at the Soviet Union's major cities in order to deter an attack. Placing the nation's nuclear arsenal on submarines would eliminate the need for split-second decision-making during a crisis. It would give the president time to think, permit the United States to apply force incrementally, and reduce the threat of all-out nuclear war. Burke argued that a strategy of massive retaliation no longer made sense. Nobody wins a suicide pact. A decade earlier, the Navy had criticized the Air Force for targeting Soviet cities, calling the policy ruthless and barbaric. Now the Navy claimed that was the only sane and ethical way to ensure world peace. As the debate over nuclear strategy grew more heated within the Eisenhower administration and in the press, General Curtis LeMay showed absolutely no interest in limited war, graduated deterrence, finite deterrence, or anything short of total victory. The United States should never enter a war, LeMay felt, unless it intended to win. And a counterforce policy that targeted the Soviet Union's nuclear assets was far more likely to prevent a war than a strategy that threatened its cities. Unlike the public mind that feared a nuclear holocaust, he argued, the professional military mind in both nations worried more about preserving the ability to fight, about losing airfields, missile bases, command centers. Sack claimed that a counterforce strategy was also the most humane method of waging war, since there was no necessity to bomb cities. But that argument was somewhat disingenuous. In order to hit military targets, LeMay acknowledged, weapons must be delivered with either very high accuracy or very high yield or both. Because the accuracy of a bomb was less predictable than its yield, he favored the use of powerful weapons. They could miss a target and still destroy it, or destroy multiple targets at once. They would also, unavoidably, kill millions of civilians. LeMay wanted SAC to deploy a hydrogen bomb with a yield of 60 megatons, a bomb more than 4,000 times more powerful than the one that destroyed Hiroshima. By the late 1950s, the absence of a clear targeting policy and the size of America's stockpile had created serious command and control problems. The Army, the Navy, and the Air Force all planned to attack the Soviet Union with nuclear weapons, but had done little to coordinate their efforts. Until 1957, the Strategic Air Command refused to share its target list with the other armed services. When the services finally met to compare war plans, hundreds of time-over-target conflicts were discovered. Cases in which, for example, the Air Force and the Navy unwittingly planned to bomb the same target at the same time. These conflicts promised to cause unnecessary overkill and threaten the lives of American air crews. The Joint Chiefs of Staff soon recognized that the chaos of war would be bad enough without competing nuclear war plans to make it worse. They decided that the United States had to develop atomic coordination machinery, an administrative system to control what targets would be attacked, who would attack them, which weapons would be used, and how those attacks would be timed. The decision prompted the Army, Navy, and Air Force to battle even more fiercely over who would control that system. The Air Force wanted a single atomic war plan run by a centralized command. SAC would head that command and take over the Navy's Polaris submarines. The Navy was outraged by that idea and joined the other services in offering a counterproposal. The Navy, the Air Force, and NATO should retain separate war plans, but coordinate them more efficiently. The issues at stake were fundamental, and basic questions needed to be addressed. Should the command structure be centralized or decentralized? Should the attack be all-out or incremental? Should the strategy be counterforce or city-busting? The President of the United States, once again, had to decide the best way not only to fight the Soviet Union, but also to settle a dispute over nuclear weapons at the Pentagon. During a meeting at the White House in 1956, President Eisenhower had listened patiently to General Taylor's arguments on behalf of a flexible response. Eisenhower wasn't persuaded that a war could be won without hydrogen bombs. It was fatuous to think that the U.S. and the USSR would be locked into a life-and-death struggle, he told Taylor, without using such weapons. Eisenhower thought both sides would use them at once. 4 years later, his views remained largely unchanged. If NATO forces were attacked, he said during another White House discussion of limited war, an all-out strike on the Soviet Union would be the only practical choice. Pausing to negotiate a diplomatic settlement seemed unrealistic. That sort of thing happened only in novels like Red Alert. Confronted with the choice between destroying Soviet military targets or cities, Eisenhower decided that the United States should destroy both. The new targeting philosophy combined elements of Air Force and Navy doctrine. It was called the Optimum Mix. In August 1960, General Nathan Twining, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, resolved the dispute over how a nuclear war would be planned and controlled. A joint strategic target planning staff would be formed. Most of the officers would be drawn from the Air Force, although the other services would be represented. The targeting staff would be based at SAC headquarters in Omaha and led by SAC's commander. The Navy could keep its Polaris submarines, but the aiming points of their missiles would be chosen in Omaha. Twining ordered that a single integrated operational plan, PSYOP, be completed by the end of the year. The PSYOP would serve as America's nuclear war plan. The PSYOP would spell out precisely when, how, and by whom every enemy target would be struck. And the PSYOP would be inflexible. Twining had instructed that atomic operations must be pre-planned for automatic execution to the maximum extent possible. The Navy was furious about the new arrangement. Admiral Burke thought it represented a power grab by the Air Force and later accused the Strategic Air Command of using exactly the same techniques, the methods of control favored by the communists. And he warned that once the PSYOP was adopted, it would be hard to change. The systems will be laid, Burke told William B. Frank, the Secretary of the Navy. The grooves will be dug, and the power will be there because the money will be there. the electronic industry, and all of those things. We will wreck this country if we are not careful. President Eisenhower was unfazed by Burke's critique of the PSYOP, its underlying strategy, and its command and control machinery. "This whole thing has to be on a completely integrated basis," Eisenhower said. "The initial strike must be simultaneous." The strategic planning staff gathered in Omaha to write the first PSYOP, under tremendous pressure to complete it within 4 months. Their process would be as rational, impersonal, and automated as possible. The first step was to create a national strategic target list. They began by poring through the Air Force's Bombing Encyclopedia, a compendium of more than 80,000 potential targets located throughout the world. The book gave a brief description of each target, its longitude and latitude and elevation, its category, such as military or industrial, airfield or oil refinery, and its BE number, a unique 8-digit identifier. From that lengthy inventory, 12,000 candidates in the Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc, and China were selected. A target weighing system was adopted to measure their relative importance. Every target was assigned a certain number of points. Those with the most points were deemed the most essential to destroy. And the National Strategic Target List, as a whole, was given a total value of 5 million points. All of this data, the BE numbers, the target locations, and the numerical points were fed into SAC's latest IBM computer. What emerged was a series of desired ground zeros, containing multiple targets at which America's nuclear weapons would be aimed. Once the target list was complete and the ground zeros identified, the planners calculated the most efficient way to destroy them. A wide assortment of variables had to be taken into account, including the accuracy and reliability of different weapons systems, the effectiveness of Soviet air defenses, the impact of darkness or poor weather, and the rate at which low-flying aircraft were likely to crash due to unknown causes, known as the clobber factor. The Joint Chiefs specified that the odds of a target being destroyed had to be at least 75%, and for some targets, the rate of damage assurance was put even higher. Achieving that level of assurance required cross-targeting, aiming more than one nuclear weapon at a single ground zero. After the numbers were crunched, the PSYOP often demanded that a target be hit by multiple weapons, arriving from different directions at different times. One high-value target in the Soviet Union would be hit by a Jupiter missile, a Titan missile, an Atlas missile, and hydrogen bombs dropped by 3 B-52s, simply to guarantee its destruction. The PSYOP would unfold in phases. The alert force would be launched within the first hour, the full force in waves over the course of 28 hours. And then the PSYOP ended. The Strategic Air Command was responsible for striking most of the ground zeros. Tactics programmed for the PSYOP are in two principal categories, the head of the Joint Chiefs later explained, the penetration phase and the delivery phase. SAC would attack the Soviet Union front to rear, hitting air defenses along the border first, then penetrating more deeply into the nation's interior and destroying targets along the way, a tactic called bomb as you go. Great Britain's strategic weapons were controlled by the PSYOP as well. The Royal Air Force showed little interest in SAC's ideas about counterforce. The British philosophy of strategic bombing had changed little since the Second World War, and the RAF's Bomber Command wanted to use its nuclear weapons solely for city busting. The PSYOP respected the British preference, asking Bomber Command to destroy 3 air bases, 6 air defense targets, and 48 cities. George Kistjakowski, the president's science advisor, visited SAC headquarters in November 1960. To get a sense of how work was proceeding on the PSYOP. Kistjakowski was hardly a peacenik. He'd fled the Soviet Union as a young man, designed the high-explosive lenses for the Trinity device, and later shared the Air Force's concerns about a missile gap. but he was shocked by the destructiveness of the psyop. The damage levels caused by the alert force alone would be so great that any additional nuclear strike seemed like unnecessary and undesirable overkill. Kiszczakowski thought that the full force would deliver enough megatons to kill 4 and 5 times over somebody who was already dead, and that SAC should be allowed to take just 1 whack, not 10 whacks, at each Soviet target. Nevertheless, he told Eisenhower, "I believe that the presently developed PSYOP is the best that could be expected under the circumstances, and that it should be put into effect." At the beginning of the effort to devise a new war plan, Eisenhower had expressed opposition to any strategy that required a 100% pulverization of the Soviet Union. He could still remember when the Pentagon said the Soviets had no more than 70 targets worth destroying. "There was obviously a limit," he told his national security staff, "a human limit to the devastation which human beings could endure." On December 2, 1960, Eisenhower approved the PSYOP without requesting any changes. The PSYOP would take effect the following April. It featured 3,729 targets, grouped into more than 1,000 ground zeros that would be struck by 3,423 nuclear weapons. The targets were located in the Soviet Union, China, North Korea, and Eastern Europe. About 80% were military targets, and the rest were civilian. Of the urban industrial complexes scheduled for destruction, 295 were in the Soviet Union and 78 in China. The PSYOP's damage and casualty estimates were conservative. They were based solely on blast effects. They excluded the harm that might be caused by thermal radiation, fires, or fallout, which were difficult to calculate with precision. Within 3 days of the initial attack, the full force of the PSYOP would kill about 54% of the Soviet Union's population and about 16% of China's population, roughly 220 million people. Millions more would subsequently die from burns, radiation poisoning, exposure. The PSYOP was designed for a national emergency when the survival of the United States was at stake, and the decision to launch the PSYOP would carry an almost unbearable weight. Once the PSYOP was set in motion, it could not be altered, slowed, or stopped. The PSYOP soon became one of the most closely guarded secrets in the United States. But the procedures for authorizing a nuclear strike were kept even more secret. For years, the Joint Chiefs had asked not only for custody of America's nuclear weapons, but also for the authority to use them. In December 1956, the military had gained permission to use nuclear weapons in air defense. In February 1959, the military had gained custody of all the thermonuclear weapons stored at Army, Navy, and Air Force facilities. The Atomic Energy Commission retained custody of only those kept at its own storage sites. And in December 1959, the military had finally won the kind of control that it had sought since the end of the Second World War. Eisenhower agreed to let high-ranking commanders decide whether to use nuclear weapons during an emergency when the president couldn't be reached. He had wrestled with the decision, well aware that such advance authorization could allow someone to do something foolish down the chain of command and start an all-out nuclear war. But the alternative would be to let American and NATO forces be overrun and destroyed if communications with Washington were disrupted. At first, Eisenhower told the Joint Chiefs that he was very fearful of having written papers on this matter. Later, he agreed to sign a pre-delegation order, insisting that its existence never be revealed. "It is in the U.S. interest to maintain the atmosphere that all authority to use nuclear weapons stays with the U.S. president without delegation," he stressed. Eisenhower's order was kept secret from Congress, the American people, and NATO allies. It made sense as a military tactic, but it also introduced an element of uncertainty to the decision-making process. The PSYOP was centralized, inflexible, and mechanistic. The pre-delegation order was exactly the opposite. It would rely on individual judgments made in the heat of battle, thousands of miles from the White House. Under certain circumstances, a U.S. commander under attack with conventional weapons would be allowed to respond with nuclear weapons. Eisenhower knew all too well that delegating presidential authority could mean losing control of whether, how, and why a nuclear war would be fought. He understood the contradictions at the heart of America's command and control system, but couldn't find a way to resolve them during his last few weeks in office. Breaking in. Colonel John T. Moser and his wife had just finished dinner, and they were getting ready to leave the house for a concert when the phone rang. "There's a problem at Launch Complex 3747," the controller said. "It could be a fire." Moser told his wife to go without him, put on his uniform, got in his car, and headed to the command post. They lived on the base, and the drive didn't take long. On the way, Moser radioed ahead, telling the controller to assemble the missile potential hazard team. It was 6:40 in the evening, about 10 minutes after a mysterious white cloud had appeared in the silo. The command post of the 308th Strategic Missile Wing resembled an executive boardroom, with a long conference table in the middle, communications equipment, and a chalkboard. It could accommodate 25 or 30 people. Moser was the wing commander, and when he arrived at the post, it was still largely empty, and the status of the missile unclear. The sprays were on, dumping water into the silo. Stage 1 fuel pressure was falling, while the oxidizer pressure was rising. Flashing red lights in the control center at 4-7 warned there was a fuel leak, an oxidizer leak, a fire in the silo. Three things that couldn't be happening at once. Adding to the confusion, Captain Mazzaro and Lieutenant Childers, the crew commander and deputy commander at the site, had both called the command post using separate lines, one mentioning a fuel leak, the other a fire. Now Mazzaro was on the speakerphone, reporting the missile's tank pressures. His crew was going through checklists, trying to make sense of it all. Moser was a great believer in checklists. After graduating from Franklin and Marshall College in 1955, he'd joined the Strategic Air Command. 2 years later, he became the navigator of a KC-97 Stratotanker, an aircraft that refueled B-47 bombers mid-air. The Stratotanker was a propeller plane, and the B-47 a jet, prone to stalling at low speeds. The two had to rendezvous at a precise location, with the bomber flying behind and slightly below the tanker. At an altitude of 18,000 feet, they would connect via a hollow steel boom and fly in unison for 20 minutes, entering a shallow dive so that the tanker could keep up with the bomber. Aerial refueling was a delicate, often dangerous procedure. The crew of the Stratotanker had to coordinate every step carefully, not just with the crew of the B-47, but also with one another. Spontaneous or improvised maneuvers would not be appreciated. Moser later flew as a navigator on KC-135 tankers that refueled B-52s during airborne alerts. The success of these missions depended on checklists. Every move had to be standardized and predictable, as two large jets flew about 40 feet apart, linked by a boom, one plane carrying thermonuclear weapons, the other unloading 1,000 gallons of jet fuel a minute, day or night, through air turbulence and rough weather. Colonel Moser asked Mazzaro if the PTS team had done anything in the silo that could have caused the problem. Mazzaro got off the line and returned with an explanation. Airman Powell had dropped a socket into the silo, and the socket had pierced a hole in the Stage 1 fuel tank. Mazzaro put the airman on the phone and made him describe what had happened, an unusual decision that violated the chain of command. Hearing the details silenced everyone in the room. Moser realized this was a serious accident that called for an urgent response. He activated the missile potential hazard net, a conference call that would connect him with SAC headquarters in Omaha, the Ogden Air Logistics Center in Utah, and the headquarters of the 8th Air Force in Louisiana. But the communications equipment wasn't working properly, and for the next 40 minutes the controller in Little Rock tried to set up the call. Members of the hazard team were now filling the command post, officers and enlisted men who'd spent years working with the Titan II and its propellants. The missile wing's chief of safety sat at the conference table, along with the head of its technical engineering branch, a bio-environmental engineer, an electrical engineer, and the K crew. The K stood for on-call, and the four-man crew, a commander, a deputy commander, a missile facilities technician, and a missile systems analyst, served as backup to the launch crew at 4-7. The K crew could help interpret the data coming from the site, pore through the Dash 1 and other operating manuals, offer a second opinion. The skills of everyone in the room focused on the question of how to save the missile. SAC didn't have a checklist for the problem they now faced, and so they would have to write one. Moser needed all the technical assistance he could get. He was new to the job, having been in Little Rock for about 3 months. During that brief time, he'd come to be regarded as smart, fair, and open-minded, as someone who was willing to listen. For a SAC wing commander, he was well-liked. But Moser didn't know very much about Titan II missiles. He'd previously served as deputy director of missile maintenance at SAC headquarters and as the commander of missile maintenance at Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri. Those assignments, however, had required an extensive knowledge of Minuteman missiles, a completely different weapon system. The Minuteman used solid fuel, not liquid propellants. It was smaller than a Titan II with a less powerful warhead, and each Minuteman complex had 10 missiles, not one, with silos dispersed as far as 17 miles from the launch control center. A Minuteman crew could go months without visiting a silo. The Titan II was the only ballistic missile in the American arsenal that relied on liquid fuel and a combat crew living down the hall. It was a rare, exotic bird. Of the more than 1,000 long-range missiles that SAC controlled, only 54 were Titan IIs. Moser didn't pretend to be an expert on the Titan II, and from his first day in Little Rock had shown an eagerness to learn. 3 or 4 mornings a week, he attended pre-departure briefings for the launch crews and the PTS teams. He vowed to spend time at every launch complex before the end of the year. But some of the complexes were a long way from Little Rock, and he still hadn't visited them all. When Colonel James L. Morris arrived at the command post around 7 p.m., he already knew what had happened at the silo. Morris was the deputy commander for maintenance, and about half an hour earlier, he'd overheard Captain Mazzaro on the radio, sounding excited about something. Morris told Job Control to call 4-7 and ask Charles Heineman, the head of PTS Team A, what was going on there. Heineman said that Powell had dropped a socket into the silo and poked a hole in the missile. He said that Powell saw a lot of fuel vapor but no fire. Morris absorbed the news, told Job Control to track down Jeff Kennedy, and ordered the dispatcher not to contact the launch complex again. Within an hour of the accident, the pressure in the Stage 1 fuel tank had dropped by about 80%. A vacuum was forming inside it as fuel poured out. If the pressure continued to drop, the tank might collapse. After Jeff Kennedy joined Morris in the command post, Colonel Moser briefed them on the situation and instructed them to head to 4-7 by helicopter. Morris would serve as the on-site commander, and Kennedy would help him find out what was happening, whether there was a fire, and what needed to be done. Before leaving Little Rock, Kennedy asked Job Control to call the launch complex and tell them to get a REFCO suit ready for him. "We've been ordered not to call the complex," the dispatcher said. "Bring your own." Kennedy didn't have time to gather the necessary gear, a helmet, a fresh air pack, a REFCO suit the right size, and left the base without it. The hazard team had come up with a plan. PTS technicians would re-enter the silo, vent the Stage 1 fuel tank, equalize the pressure, and prevent the missile from collapsing. Time was of the essence, and the re-entry had to be done as soon as possible. The PTS men topside had refcos and air packs and a full set of equipment in their trucks. Ideally, they'd go into the complex. But nobody knew where they were. After leaving the complex, they'd probably driven beyond the range of the radios in their helmets. And their trucks didn't have radios that could contact the base. If they wanted to speak with the command post, they'd have to drive to Damascus and use a payphone, or call from a nearby house. The PTS crew that had taken refuge in the control center would have to do the job, wearing the refcos left behind in the blast lock. Because their socket was now lying somewhere at the bottom of the silo, they'd have to remove the pressure cap on the Stage 1 fuel tank with pliers. And if that didn't work, they might have to push open the tank's poppet valve with a broom handle. Before Colonel Moser could approve the plan and set it in motion, SAC headquarters joined the discussion via speakerphone. It was about 7:45. The missile potential hazard net was finally up and running, and Lieutenant General Lloyd Levitt, the vice commander in chief of the Strategic Air Command, was on the line. Levitt made it clear that from now on, nothing would be done in the launch control center, the silo, or anywhere else on the complex without his approval. And he would not authorize any specific action until a consensus had been reached that it was the right thing to do. Levitt was in his early 50s, short, compact, and self-confident. He'd been a member of the first class to enter West Point after the Second World War. While the heroism of that war was celebrated in popular books and films, his classmates were soon risking their lives in a conflict that was largely ignored by the public. Levitt became a fighter pilot and flew 100 combat missions during the Korean War. He routinely encountered enemy planes and anti-aircraft fire. During one mission, his F-84 was hit by flak and suffered an electrical failure. Levitt had to fly 250 miles without flight instruments or a radio before landing safely at an American base. During another, his plane spun out of control amid a snowstorm. Levitt had to bail out at 8,000 feet and felt lucky to be found by South Korean troops, not communist guerrillas. He later flew 152 combat missions in Vietnam. The two conflicts, as well as training flights, took the lives of many good friends. Of the 119 West Pointers who graduated from flight school with Levitt, 7 were killed in Korea, 2 in Vietnam, and 13 in airplane accidents. The odds of being killed on the job for his classmates was about 1 in 6. Some of Levitt's most dangerous missions occurred during peacetime. From 1957 to 1960, he flew U-2 spy planes. The U-2 was designed to fly long distances and take photographs at an altitude of 70,000 feet without being detected or shot down. In order to do so, the plane had to be kept as light as possible, and the small size of the pilot's survival kit imposed certain restrictions. Before leaving on a mission to photograph Soviet airfields and radar sites in Siberia, Levitt was given a choice: bring a life raft or a warm parka. He wasn't allowed to bring both. Levitt chose the parka, figuring that if he had to bail out over the Bering Sea, he'd freeze to death, with or without the raft. U-2 pilots flew alone, in a tiny cockpit, wearing cumbersome pressure suits and maintaining complete radio silence for as long as 9 hours. The plane was difficult to fly. It was fragile and stalled easily. Strong G-forces could break it apart mid-air. To save weight, it had only 2 sets of landing gear, one in the front and the other in the back. Landing the U-2, Levitt wrote in his memoir, was like landing a bicycle at 100 miles per hour. Of the 38 U-2 pilots with whom he trained, 8 died flying the plane. The missile potential hazard net was rarely activated, and the commander of SAC usually led it. But General Richard H. Ellis was out of town, and so Levitt, the second in command, took his place. Levitt got on the net from the balcony of SAC's underground command post overlooking the world map. Although he'd flown B-52s for a year, worked at the Pentagon, commanded an Air Force training center, and served on the staff of a NATO general, Levitt still had the manner of an old-fashioned fighter pilot. Cocky, decisive, self-reliant. He did not, however, have first-hand experience working with Titan II missiles. Nor did Colonel Russell Kennedy, the director of missile maintenance at SAC headquarters, who joined Levitt on the balcony. They would have to rely on the advice and the expertise of others. The presence of a white hazy cloud on the other side of Blast Door 8 was ominous. Regardless of whether it was fuel vapor or smoke, it shouldn't have been there when Gregory Lester opened the door, hoping to grab the refcos. That meant Blast Door 9, leading to the cableway and the silo, had somehow been breached. That meant Blast Door 8 was all that stood between the men in the launch control center and a cloud of toxic, perhaps explosive fumes. The plan to re-enter the silo was scrapped. Captain Mazzaro had already asked for permission to evacuate. Now he asked for it again, and Heinemann, speaking on behalf of his PTS crew, wholeheartedly backed the request. At the Little Rock command post, the hazard team debated what to do next. For the moment, their options were limited. The PTS team topside was still missing. Colonel Morris and Jeff Kennedy were en route in the helicopter but hadn't brought along air packs and refcos. Rodney Holder, the missile systems analyst technician at 4-7, was getting ready to power down the missile so that a stray electrical spark wouldn't ignite fuel vapor in the silo. Once the main circuit breakers were shut off, the men in the control center could do little more than stare at the changing tank pressures on the PTPMU. The K crew worried about the safety of their counterparts at 4-7. Captain Jackie Wells, a member of the K crew, thought that if the missile collapsed, the fuel vapor that had leaked into the blast lock might ignite and rupture Blast Door 8. Even if the door held, debris from a large explosion might trap everyone in the control center. The blast doors and the escape hatch were supposed to ensure the crew's survival, even after a nuclear detonation. But a Titan II complex had not yet faced that sort of test, and Wells thought the risks of leaving people in the control center outweighed any potential benefit. The K crew advised Colonel Moser to order an evacuation. Sergeant Michael Hansen, the chief of PTS Team B, who was in the command post preparing to lead a convoy to the site, agreed. He didn't think the control center would survive a blast, and he wanted his buddies to get out of there right away. Captain Charles E. Clark, the wing's chief technical engineer, said that the crew should stay right where they were. He had faith in the blast doors, and he warned Colonel Moser that if the crew left, the command post would have no way of knowing the tank pressures inside the missile and no means of operating the equipment within the complex. Clark argued that the crew should remain in the control center, monitor the status of the missile, and open the massive silo door above it. Opening the door would dilute the fuel vapor with air, making the vapor less flammable. The temperature in the silo would drop, and as the oxidizer tanks cooled, they'd become less likely to burst. Opening the door wouldn't pose much of a threat to Damascus. Unlike the oxidizer, the fuel would dissipate rapidly in the atmosphere. It wouldn't travel for miles, sickening people and killing cattle. First Lieutenant Michael J. Rusden, the bioenvironmental engineer, had calculated that with the winds prevailing at the moment, a toxic corridor would extend only 400 to 600 feet beyond the silo. After consulting with SAC headquarters, Colonel Moser ordered everyone to evacuate the control center, and he asked SAC if the crew should open the silo door before they left. That door was not to be opened under any circumstances, General Levitt said. The idea wasn't even worth discussing. Levitt wanted the fuel vapors fully contained in the silo. He did not want a cloud of Aerozine 50 floating over nearby houses and farms. More important, he didn't want to risk losing control of a thermonuclear weapon. Levitt felt absolutely certain that if the missile blew up, the warhead wouldn't detonate. He'd been around nuclear weapons for almost 30 years. In 1952, he'd been secretly trained to deliver atomic bombs from a fighter plane in case they were needed during the Korean War. He had complete faith in the safety mechanisms of the W-53 warhead atop the Titan II. But nobody could predict how far the warhead would travel if the missile exploded with the silo door open. Levitt didn't want a thermonuclear weapon landing in a backyard somewhere between Little Rock and St. Louis. Maintaining control of the warhead was far more important, he thought, than any other consideration. The K-crew waited tensely to hear if the men had made it out of the control center. Before abandoning the complex, the launch crew had left the phone off the hook. And when the intruder alarm suddenly went off at 4-7, the sound could be heard over the phone in the command post. That meant someone topside had opened the door to the escape hatch. More time passed without any word, and then Sergeant Brocksmith was on the radio, saying that he had everyone in his pickup truck. Sergeant Hansen left the command post and went to the PTS shop, where Sandaker and the other volunteers were gathering their equipment. The disaster response force left the base at about 9 o'clock, but PTS Team B needed more time to get ready. Once they arrived at 4-7, Hansen thought the plan would go something like this. Two men would put on refcos, enter the complex through the access portal, open the blast doors, walk down the long cableway to the silo, and try to vent the missile. Perhaps they'd also turn on the purge fan to clear vapors from the silo. Unsure of what equipment was available at 4-7, Hansen decided that PTS Team B had to bring everything it needed. They had to gather the gear, load it into 5 trucks, stop at 2 other missile complexes, and pick up items that the shop didn't have. Although PTS Team B wanted to get to 4-7 as quickly as possible, logistical problems delayed them, including an unexpected stop for water. Hansen's truck was the only one with a radio. Whenever he needed to communicate with the others, the entire convoy would have to pull over to the side of the road, and someone would get out of the truck to explain their next move. The Little Rock command post continued to have communications difficulties as well. Once the control center was evacuated, the radio in Sergeant Brocksmith's truck became the only way to speak with people at the missile site. Unfortunately, the radio transmissions from his truck weren't scrambled or secure. Anyone who knew the right frequency could listen to them, and the sound quality was less than ideal. Major Joseph A. Kinderman, the head of the wing's security police, who manned the radio at the command post, found that conversations were sometimes garbled and difficult to understand. At about 9:30, Major Kinderman reported the latest set of tank pressures, and a sergeant added them to the chalkboard. For a moment, everyone focused on the pressure in the Stage 1 fuel tank. During the hour since the last reading, it had fallen from -0.7 to -2 PSI. Those numbers were disturbing. They suggested the tank was on the verge of collapse. And then a member of the K crew wondered, how the hell does anyone know what the tank pressures are? The control center had been evacuated at about 8:30. Kinderman asked Colonel Morris where those numbers came from. Morris had provided the numbers, but didn't answer the question. He was sitting in Brocksmith's security police truck, parked at the end of the access road off Highway 65. Kinderman waited for a reply, and then Captain Mazzaro got on the radio and said that Kennedy had re-entered the control center without permission, violating the two-man rule. Members of the K crew couldn't believe what Kennedy had just done. Colonel Moser was more upset than angry, and he wasn't thrilled about telling SAC headquarters. But the information that Kennedy obtained was extremely useful. Moser shared the numbers with everyone on the net and described Kennedy's unauthorized behavior. General Levitt seemed unperturbed. Although one of SAC's cardinal rules had just been broken, Levitt appreciated the importance of having the latest tank pressures and the personal risk that Kennedy had taken to get them. Colonel Morris was told not to allow any further actions at the launch complex without the approval of SAC headquarters. And while the PTS convoy drove to 4-7, the discussion on the net turned to whether the power at the complex should be completely shut off. The crew had turned off everything they could before leaving, but the water pumps on level 8 of the silo were still running, as were a series of fans, motors, and relays connected to the air conditioning and ventilation systems. General Levitt worried that a spark from one of these motors or the slightest bit of electrical arcing could ignite the fuel vapor in the silo. The command post called the Petitjean Electric Company, the local utility in Damascus, and asked it to send over workers who could climb the poles and disconnect the jacks from power lines leading to the complex. The majority of the hazard team in Little Rock wanted to leave the power on. If the power were cut, the phone in the control center would go dead, and they wouldn't be able to monitor the vapor detector left behind there. The sound of the detector going off would signal that fuel vapor had seeped past Blast Door 8. Anyone who re-entered the complex to save the missile would find the job more difficult without power. You wouldn't be able to check tank pressures, turn on the purge fan, or do anything in the silo, aside from removing the pressure cap by hand and venting the Stage 1 fuel tank. The workers from Petitjean were told to stand by, and for the time being, the power stayed on. An executive from Martin Marietta, the manufacturer of the Titan II, had joined the net, giving estimates of the tank pressures at which the Stage 1 fuel tank was likely to collapse and the oxidizer tank to burst. The situation felt grim. Nevertheless, members of the hazard net debated how PTS Team B should proceed, step by step, upon their arrival at 4-7. First, everyone had to reach a consensus on the proper course of action, and then they had to write a checklist for it. The audio quality of the conference call was mediocre, and with so many people involved in the discussion, at half a dozen locations, it was often hard to figure out who was saying what. One of the most authoritative voices had a strong Texan accent. It belonged to Colonel Ben Scallorn, the Deputy Chief of Staff for Missiles at 8th Air Force Headquarters in Louisiana. Moser had served under Scallorn at Whiteman Air Force Base and phoned him right after hearing about the accident in Damascus, wanting to get his opinion, privately, of how bad it sounded. Scallorn didn't sugar the pill. He thought it sounded really bad. He knew the Titan II as well as just about anyone else at SAC. He'd worked long hours in silos wearing a REFCO and seen firsthand how dangerous the missile could be. During the discussions on the missile potential hazard net, he was blunt about what needed to be done at 4-7, regardless of whether anyone would listen. When Ben Scallorn first reported to Little Rock Air Force Base in 1962, the Titan II silos there were still being dug. The Missile Maintenance Department consisted of three people, a first lieutenant who ran it, a sergeant who served as his clerk, and a secretary. The 308th Strategic Missile Wing had not yet been activated, and the Air Force was eager to get the Titan IIs into the ground. Scallorn was glad to be in Little Rock, preparing to study missile maintenance. His previous assignment in the Air Force had been recreational services. For years, he'd managed softball fields, swimming pools, movie theaters, and service clubs at SAC bases everywhere from Mississippi to Morocco. He was 33, with a wife and three small boys. Helping to deploy America's largest ballistic missile at the dawn of the missile age promised to be a more rewarding career path. He was sent to Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls, Texas, to learn how the Titan II worked, and 6 weeks later returned to Little Rock as Chief of Maintenance Training at the 308th. Scallorn visited the launch complexes around Little Rock as they were being constructed. Each one was a massive endeavor, requiring about 4.5 million pounds of steel and about 30 million pounds of concrete. Elaborate water, power, and hydraulic systems had to be laid underground. The silo door was too heavy to be transported by road. It arrived in 8 pieces for assembly at the site. In order to bring missiles on alert as quickly as possible, the Air Force relied on a management practice known as concurrency. Work began on the Titan II complexes long before a Titan II missile had flown. Both would be completed at roughly the same time. The Air Force also used concurrency to speed the deployment of other ballistic missiles. Led by the Army Corps of Engineers, tens of thousands of workers dug hundreds of silos to hide missiles beneath the landscape of rural America. It was one of the largest construction projects ever undertaken by the Department of Defense. In addition to Arkansas, underground launch complexes were placed in Arizona, California, Colorado, Idaho, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, New Mexico, New York, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Texas, Washington, and Wyoming. Between Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana and Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota, missile silos were dispersed across an area extending for 32,000 square miles. About an hour north of Santa Barbara, along a stretch of the central California coast with 40 miles of pristine beaches and rocky cliffs, the Air Force built a missile research center and the first operational missile site. Later known as Vandenberg Air Force Base, it provided a clear shot to target sites at Eniwetok and Kwajalein in the Marshall Islands. Like the missile complexes in America's heartland, Vandenberg was rushed to completion. Within a few years of its opening in 1957, the base had launch pads, silos, underground control centers, storage facilities, administrative buildings, and a population of about 10,000. Although concurrency sped the introduction of new weapons, it also created problems. A small design change in a missile could require costly changes in silo equipment that had already been installed. The prototype of a new airplane could be flight tested repeatedly to discover its flaws, but a missile could be flown only once. And missiles were expensive, limiting the number of flight tests and the opportunity to learn what could go wrong. A successful launch depended on an intricate mix of human and technological factors. Design errors were often easier to correct than to anticipate. As a result, the reliability of America's early missiles left much to be desired. Like any machine, General LeMay noted with understatement, they don't always work. The first intercontinental missile deployed by the United States, the Snark, had wings, a jet engine, and a range of about 6,000 miles. It was a great-looking missile, sleek and futuristic, painted a fiery red. But the Snark soon became legendary for landing nowhere near its target. On long-distance flights, it missed by an average of 20 miles or more. During one test launch from Cape Canaveral, Florida, a Snark that was supposed to fly no farther than Puerto Rico just kept on going, despite repeated attempts by range safety officers to make it self-destruct. When the slow-moving missile passed Puerto Rico, fighter planes were scrambled to shoot it down, but they couldn't find it. The Snark eventually ran out of fuel and crashed somewhere in the Amazonian rainforests of Brazil. Air Force tests later suggested that during wartime, only 1 out of 3 Snarks would leave the ground, and only 1 out of 10 would hit its target. Nevertheless, dozens of Snarks were put on alert at Presque Isle Air Force Base in Maine. The missile carried a 4-megaton warhead. Again and again, the symbolism of a missile seemed more important than its military usefulness. The Army's Redstone missile was rushed into the field not long after the Soviet Union launched Sputnik. Designed by Wernher von Braun and his team of German rocket scientists at the Redstone Arsenal in Huntsville, Alabama, the missile was a larger, more advanced version of the Nazi V-2. The Redstone often carried a 4-megaton warhead, but couldn't fly more than 175 miles. The combination of a short range and a powerful thermonuclear weapon was unfortunate. Launched from NATO bases in West Germany, Redstone missiles would destroy a fair amount of West Germany. The intermediate-range missiles that President Eisenhower offered to NATO were also problematic. The Thor missiles sent to Great Britain were stored above ground, lying horizontally. They had to be erected and then fueled before liftoff. It would take at least 15 minutes to launch any of the missiles in a Thor squadron, and even longer to get them all off the ground. The missiles' lack of physical protection, lengthy countdown procedures, and close proximity to the Eastern Bloc guaranteed that they'd be among the first things destroyed by a Soviet attack. The 4-minute warning provided by Great Britain's radar system wouldn't offer much help to the RAF officers in charge of a Thor squadron that might need as much as 2 days to complete its mission. They might not have time to launch any Thors. The missiles would, however, be useful for a surprise attack against the Soviet Union, a fact that gave the Soviets an even greater incentive to strike first and destroy them. Instead of deterring an attack on Great Britain, the Thors seemed to invite one. The military value of the Jupiter missiles offered to Italy and Turkey was equally dubious. Jupiters were also slow to launch, stored above ground, and exposed to attack. Unlike the Thors, they stood upright, encircled by launch equipment hidden beneath metal panels. When the panels opened outward before liftoff, a Jupiter looked like the pistil of a huge, white, sinister flower. 60 feet high, topped by a 1.4-megaton warhead and deployed in the countryside, the missiles were especially vulnerable to lightning strikes. In the days and months following Sputnik, the Atlas missile loomed as America's great hope, its first ICBM, designed to hit Soviet targets from bases in the United States. But producing a missile that could reliably reach the Soviet Union took much longer than expected. An Air Force missile expert later described its propellant system as a fire waiting to happen. Liquid oxygen, LOX, the missile's oxidizer, was dangerously unstable. About 20,000 gallons of LOX had to be stored in tanks outside the Atlas at a temperature of minus 297 degrees Fahrenheit, and then pumped into the missile during the countdown. The margin for error was slim. During a series of dramatic, well-publicized mishaps at Vandenberg, Atlas missiles exploded on the launch pad, veered wildly off course, or never left the ground. Nevertheless, the first Atlas went on alert in 1959. At a top-secret hearing 2 years later, an Air Force official admitted to Congress that the odds of an Atlas missile hitting a target in the Soviet Union were no better than 50-50. General Thomas Power, the head of SAC, who much preferred bombers, thought the odds were closer to zero. Developed as a backup to Atlas, the Titan missile incorporated a number of new technologies. It had a second stage that ignited in the upper atmosphere, enabling the launch of a heavier payload. Although it relied on the same propellants as the Atlas, the Titan would be based in an underground silo, gaining some protection from a Soviet attack. The missile would be filled with propellants underground about 15 minutes before launch, and then would ride an elevator to the surface before ignition. The elevator was immense, capable of lifting more than 500,000 pounds. But it didn't always work. During a test run of the first Titan silo, overlooking the Pacific at Vandenberg, a control valve in the elevator's hydraulic system broke. The elevator, the Titan, and about 170,000 pounds of liquid oxygen and fuel fell all the way to the bottom of the silo. Nobody was hurt by the explosion, though debris from it landed more than a mile away. The silo was destroyed and never rebuilt. While Atlas and Titan missiles were being prepared for their launch complexes, the Air Force debated whether to deploy another liquid-fueled long-range missile, the Titan II. It would be more accurate and reliable, carry a larger warhead, store propellants within its airframe, launch from inside a silo, and lift off in less than a minute. Those were compelling arguments on behalf of the Titan II, and yet critics of the missile asked a good question. Did the Air Force really need 4 different types of ICBM? It had already committed to the development of the Minuteman, a missile that would be small, mass-produced, and inexpensive. The Minuteman's solid fuel would burn slowly from one end like a big cigar and didn't pose the same risks as liquid propellants. Donald Quarles was one of the leading skeptics at the Pentagon, eager to cut costs and avoid the unnecessary duplication of weapon systems. No longer Secretary of the Air Force, he was the second highest-ranking official at the Pentagon, rumored to be Eisenhower's choice to become the next Secretary of Defense. And then Quarles suddenly died of a heart attack amid the long hours and great stress of his job. Funding of the Titan II was soon approved, largely due to the size of its warhead. General LeMay didn't care much for the Atlas, Titan, or Minuteman, missiles whose only strategic use was the annihilation of cities. But the Titan II, with its 9 megatons, was the kind of weapon he liked. It could destroy the deep underground bunkers where the Soviet leadership might hide, even without a direct hit. One of the many challenges that the designers of the Titan II faced was how to bring the warhead close to its target. The Titan II's rocket engines burned for only the first 5 minutes of flight. They provided a good, strong push, enough to lift the warhead above the Earth's atmosphere. But for the remaining half hour or so of flight, it was propelled by gravity and momentum. Ballistic missiles were extraordinarily complex machines, symbols of the space age featuring thousands of moving parts, and yet their guidance systems were based on 17th century physics and Isaac Newton's laws of motion. The principles that determined the trajectory of a warhead were the same as those that guided a rock thrown at a window. Accuracy depended on the shape of the projectile, the distance to the target, the aim and strength of the toss. Early versions of the Atlas and Titan missiles had a radio-controlled guidance system. After liftoff, ground stations received data on the flight path and transmitted commands to the missile. The system proved to be reasonably accurate, landing about half of the warheads within 2 miles of their targets. But radio interference, deliberate jamming, and the destruction